Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. For the past year on this program, we have been discussing the various policy briefs and a study examining the connection between health and social, economic, and educational opportunity in the African-American community in St. Louis City and County. The interdisciplinary study is titled For the Sake of All and was conducted by researchers at Washington and St. Louis universities. It showed significant disparities in the health and well-being in the African-American and white communities in this region. With the minority community here at about 30% of population, the impact of these differences is far-reaching. The study has culminated with a final report and a series of recommendations for resolving the disparities and impact of them. With me in studio, Jason Purnell, assistant professor at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University. He was the principal investigator in the study. Chris Kramer is president and CEO of Beyond Housing, a community improvement organization. Sandra Moore is president of Urban Strategies. It works for social and economic improvement of urban core residential communities and low-income families. She joins us by phone from Memphis. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us, Don.
Great to be here.
Jason, I'll start with you. It's been a long haul. We've been together now five times discussing what you've been finding over the last 14 months or so. If you would, just to set this up, could you give me kind of the Cliff Notes review of what this is all about and your findings?
The Cliff Notes review is that there are social and economic factors that are driving health disparities in our region. When people think about health, they very often think about access to health care, which is what we call necessary but not sufficient to deal with some of these lingering disparities. We note, for example, that in 63106, the life expectancy for a child born in that zip code is 67 years, whereas in 63105, the life expectancy is 85. So vast disparities, and that's just one example.
For the record, give me the locations of 06 and 05.
06 would be North St. Louis City, roughly around the Jeff Vanderloo neighborhood. 63105 would be Clayton in St. Louis County.
That's pretty stark.
Yes.
That's pretty stark. Sandy, let me ask you about how you've reviewed this in terms of, did you find anything particularly startling or stunning or interesting in all of this?
I think that it's all of it is all of those things, Don. It's startling, it's stunning, and it's interesting. I think you're asking me the question in the context of, I see so many communities around the country, did it startle or stun? And the answer is no. We have, you know, in community development, we understand viscerally, as practitioners on the ground, the impact of all of the built environment, all of the social service delivery systems on health and vice versa. The one thing about this report, however, that is amazingly stunning is the thoroughness of it and the deep integration across all the subject areas. And I think that is something that we should all pay deep attention to and be very proud of.
And Chris Kramer, you and I have had many conversations about the work that you do, and I know that you're not surprised by probably anything in this report.
No, and these aren't new necessary data points, right? These are things we could have done 5, 10, 15 years ago, and they would have been similar. I think for the general listener and the folks who live out in community to take the one data point that Jason gave in life expectancy differential of 18 years. That's not inconsequential. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely if that doesn't grab your attention, say, wait a minute, there's something seriously wrong with what's happening in our neighborhoods and in our communities, then I don't know what's going to grab your attention. And for me, it's an affirmation of the way we think about our work. And it's not just about housing. It's not just about health or education or jobs and economic development. It's how do you tie all these things together intentionally. And for me, and when we gave the report out to community recently at a conference as the culmination of this. At the end, what I wanted people to do was don't just take this fine document that's supremely well done by Jason's team and then put it on the shelf when you get back to the office. If this doesn't, again, startle you to say, what can we do? And then for me, the recommendations were absolutely fantastic because I think, and Jason and I talked about this before the show, most folks, I think, have a simple notion of, well, health is a medical issue. as opposed to the series of recommendations that are about financial well-being, about stability of neighborhoods, about the provision of quality pre-K in addition to some more traditional health models. So my hope is that this is a springboard for conversations that lead to action versus yet another great report that gets put up on the shelf with so many others that we've done.
As you and Jason have both mentioned the 18 years, it occurs to me that 18 years in some of the communities we're talking about is actually and literally a lifetime.
It's an entire generation lost. And what I want to respond to in what Chris said was that we're also trying to tell the story in this report about why this matters for everyone. It's not just about the African-American community. It's about the entire St. Louis region and the economic cost of some of this loss of life that's preventable.
And there is a dollar figure that you've associated with this.
There are several dollar figures. We estimated that the loss of life just due to low levels of education and poverty for African-Americans in 1 year was $3.3 billion. If we close some of the gaps and disparities in terms of mental health, we could save $27 million. If we close some of the gaps in terms of chronic disease, we could save $65 million. And we could go on with those kinds of price tags.
Are you concerned? Go ahead, Sandy.
And this very last point that Jason just made is the point that I was alluding to in my opening comment, and that is the interrelatedness of this to so many of the findings in this report, to so many of the things that really do impact us all in ways that it's stunning when we think about it. It really will drive us to action, as Chris suggests, because each of us, African American or not, can find a way in this report to understand that there is something that is impacting us adversely as a result of it.
I think it's important to note here, if you want a reaction to this, a positive reaction to it, and action, if you will, is to point out that what we're talking about is basically a consequence of poverty, correct?
Poverty is a piece of it. It's a large piece of it. And not just poverty, but concentrations of poverty.
Exactly. But it should be pointed out that the same kind of results of this would exist in poor white communities as well. It's not just talking about one element of the population.
That's certainly true. Yeah. Poverty and socioeconomic status are key drivers of health outcomes. What we see is that there's an added detriment when race becomes part of the conversation. For instance, one of the data points that kind of shocks people is that college-educated African-American women have worse birth outcomes than white women without high school education in terms of low birth weight. African-American children under the age of 1 year are three times more likely to die before their first birthday. So it can't just be explained by socioeconomic status. Race is still playing a role.
But what you're alluding to here certainly has to do with available resources in these communities.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it does I don't want to undercut your point. It does cut across racial lines in terms of these social and economic resources available to people.
Jason, do you have concerns, as Chris indicated a little while ago, his fear that this report is going to be put on the shelf? St. Louis does have a history of doing this with a number of studies of this type.
You know, I think there's something – I was thinking on the way over here. There is something in the air in St. Louis right now where we are beginning to think outside of our silos. So there's a movement afoot on something called collective impact, where a model called Ready by 21 is being used to look at the trajectory of children from birth until they get their first job. We're starting in this community to have conversations across our silos, across our sectors, and I'm actually hopeful that this sort of feeds into that tributary and becomes something stronger.
Chris, you have the same sense?
Yeah. Clearly there is an acknowledgement of what we have been doing, us practitioners, hasn't been working. And it's okay to raise our hand and say we've tried and we've worked hard. But quite frankly, the data tells us and what we know just walking around looking at communities, talking to folks, it hasn't worked. So for us, it's, an affirmation of the work we're doing in the Normandy School District boundaries in our 24-1 initiative, right, where we're trying to do literally when I first read the six recommendations, I'm like, yep. And we're working on all of those. And for us, it's an acknowledgement of unless we tie all these things together intentionally, we're still going to fail. If it's just a housing program, it's going to then it's not sufficient. If it's just a health program, it's not sufficient. If it's just a jobs program, it is not sufficient. So how do we intentionally say these are all connected? Like, look, just like our lives, we don't have to worry about a lot of these things. You know, those live a very modest middle class life, so you don't worry about most of these things, right? These things are kind of already in what happens in our day to day life. And what we're suggesting is, can we think about the delivery of programs in an intentional way that binds all of this together? So again, I think it's clearly possible. I think certainly Sandy's work, not only in St. Louis but across the country through Urban Strategies, again, is a testament to folks are thinking this way and trying to give examples and models to others that, hey, this thing is working.
Yeah, we'll go through the six recommendations point by point a little later in the program. But Sandy, let me come back to you. The point that Chris raises about the traveling you do and what you see. How does St. Louis and this region stack up with what you're seeing in other parts of the country, such as Memphis, New Orleans, San Francisco?
You know, that's a difficult question to answer because I think that the natural inclination of many people, and certainly it is my inclination, is to be a bit more critical at home. I always want things to be a bit better at home than I'm willing to be more patient in other places. But to answer your question, I think St. Louis is in the country in terms of turning neighborhoods around about where it is in the country, about midway. There are, you know, good numbers of cities that are moving ahead of us in this work, but there are lots that are behind us. I think there are some very exciting things, as Chris and Jason have alluded to, that are beginning to happen in St. Louis. And should we be smart and not put this kind of comprehensive study on the shelf? Should we continue to work collaboratively? Should we continue to really push place-based, neighborhood-focused, zip code-focused, integrated approaches to transforming how people are living? I think that we can leapfrog from where we are about midway in the country to we can really leapfrog forward. We are a manageable size. We've got very good basic systems in a lot of places. Our systems that are weak are also manageable if we have the will to do it. And I'd like to close in this comment piece right here with one thing. One of the reasons that I think we have enormous opportunity for this to not go on the shelf is the very first recommendation, and that is that there be a deep improvement in early childhood education and learning in the city of St. Louis. If that isn't something that we can viscerally and practically and own in the city, we're in trouble.
That's a subject that comes up again and again and again on this program. We have to take a break now. You just heard from Sandra Moore, president of Urban Strategies. With me in studio is Chris Kramer, president and CEO of Beyond Housing, and Professor Jason Purnell of the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University is also with us. He is the principal investigator in the Forsake of All study, which is what we're talking about today. That study examines the connection between health and opportunity in the region's African-American community. We'll come back and continue that conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get into it, we'd love to have you. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. If you'd like to send us an email, we'll take it at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And, of course, you can reach us by tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on the proposals and recommendations of the Forsake of All study that's just been completed here in St. Louis. That conversation continues after some news headlines, and here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Governor Pat Quinn is expected to sign the so-called Cupcake Bill this afternoon. The legislation was introduced after a young girl's home baking operation in the Metro East was shut down by regulations. Farmland and rural roads are underwater at several locations around Missouri as late spring rains have pushed rivers beyond their banks. Flooding was mostly minor, but thousands of acres of farmland are underwater. Portions of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers were at or near flood stage. And teachers in the Normandy School District are weighing their options in advance of the state taking over the district on July 1st. all teachers will have to reapply for their jobs. You can find more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Professor Jason Purnell of Washington University, Sandra Moore, the president of Urban Strategies, and Chris Kremeyer, president and CEO of Beyond Housing. We're talking about the Forsake of All study just recently completed. Jason, let me come back to you with regard to how you set this study up. Why take the element of healthcare and move all of your research from that particular point?
Well, actually, it was about health and not necessarily about healthcare.
Yeah, you. Thank you for correcting.
And that's an important distinction because I think very often our knee-jerk reaction for many of us is to think about healthcare when we think about health. But as we cited in some of the earlier work, if we gave everyone the education of the college educated, we'd save more lives than all the medical advances of the last 20 or 30 years. People don't think of education as a health intervention, but it's one of the most powerful health interventions we have, which makes our high school dropout rates all the more troubling. It's not just about future earnings, which are troubling enough. We estimate anywhere between $700 million and $1.5 billion left on the table when we let children drop out of school. But it's also about that truncated life expectancy. And we're actually seeing the gap widen in terms of people who have high school or less education, people who have some college or more. The gap in their life expectancy is actually getting bigger.
Sandy, your thoughts on what you've just heard?
Well, it's a powerful statement about education linked to economic opportunity, linked to long-term life expectancy, linked to economic vibrancy and vitality of an entire region. It is the carry-through thread that we've got to start to look for and look at. And I think there's no better place than starting at health, because really health is a way of neutralizing the conversation.
And then, and for us, I mean, we were intentional about picking the Normandy School District geography as our place, right? We're a place-based community development organization. Our place is the boundaries of a school district, back to Jason's point about, you know, all, so many great things happen when we nurture and care for our children, right? That's not a news flash, right? We didn't necessarily need another study that says, hey, if we invest in our kids, that's a good thing, right? Our challenge is, do we have the courage and the will to actually get it done versus saying it's important but never following through on the resources, both from private and public sector places. So for us, it's yes, education is the great jumping off point, but we also think about this idea of place, and we use a language that home matters, and that yes, home is where you physically live, but home is the life in and around where you live that fuels and draws the best out of the people that live there. So again, it's this conceptual framework for people to not unintentionally say, oh, if we just work on education alone, aha, it's magic, right? Or we just work on housing alone, aha, magic will happen. It's, again, the harder work of connecting all the pieces together, again, herding the cats and bringing folks around a common table for the collective good.
Yeah. I'm going to read the six recommendations here so that our audience will have an opportunity to digest them and perhaps have a better understanding of the kinds of things that we're talking about here. Number one is, as Sandy has indicated, invest in quality early childhood development for all children. Number two, help low to moderate income families create economic opportunities. Number three, invest in coordinated school health programs for all students. You've just alluded to that, Jason. The next one, invest in mental health awareness, screenings, treatment, and surveillance. And number five, invest in quality neighborhoods for all in St. Louis. Coordinate and expand chronic and infectious disease prevention and management. So those are the six recommendations.
Yes.
Don?
Yes, Sandy?
May I say something very quickly? This 63106 zip code that we used at the opening to compare to 63105 and to show that 18-year life expectancy disparity is a zip code that Urban works extensively in St. Louis with our partner McCormick Barron Salazar and McCormick Barron Reagan. They are the builders and the managers of about 1,800 units of housing, really good quality affordable housing in that zip code. Urban's there providing services to about 3,500 families of the 10,000 families that live in that zip code is probably a little more than 10,000. There's an enormous amount of investment happening in and around, with great things happening over in the Crown, Kandy area, and Old North and whatnot. However, we still have that big, glaring 18-year disparity. And so the point I am making here is to continue to reinforce the importance of weaving all of this together, and an entire community recognizing the loss of not having an integrated and focused approach to building health and eliminating disparity in that entire zip code. We've got a lot of the great pieces, but we haven't woven them together tightly enough yet.
I have to put them together. We were just talking off the air about a proposal in the city, Sandy, to eliminate several dozen houses in St. Louis, dilapidated vacant houses. And all's well and good, get them out of the neighborhoods where there are problem areas for kids. But there's no talk that I have heard yet about what's going to replace those buildings, and that is key. And another point that I want to make here is, in going over the list, and you've used the word several times, Sandy, the word invest keeps coming up. Well, invest to most people means dollars, having dollars to invest. Where does that come from, Jason? Who has the bucks to make the kind of changes you're recommending?
I think it can come from a number of places. One of the private-public partnerships that we highlighted was between the Boeing Corporation, Mercy Healthcare, and the St. Louis Public Schools, where there's actually a school-based clinic at Roosevelt High School now that's being administered by Mercy. I think those kinds of demonstrations, those private-public partnerships, can then grow into a more scaled-up approach. We also highlighted the county's Children's Service Fund, which is funded through a tax, but is providing mental health services throughout St. Louis County schools. I think there are a number of creative ways that we can find funding, and it's not always the case that we need new funding. Sometimes it's just using the funding that's currently there in a more coordinated, more integrated way, in the kind of way that we're talking about, leveraging those funds across sectors.
Right, and what we found in our work is, and clearly we're always looking for more resources, but it's also, again, the coordination of existing resources and getting, Beyond Housing and our not-for-profit friends working together on a more coordinated, integrated fashion that says a whole host of resources are in our community, but are they connected together? Are we saying, are you guys working together? And do you have a resource that could benefit a client of another organization? And again, systemically say, how do we work together more efficiently and effectively to the benefit of those who receive our services? And historically, we've not been driven there. We've been driven to find your own resources, do your own program, do your annual report, and we'll call it a day. And what we're suggesting, what funders like Boeing and others are saying, you need to work together to have greater outcomes, because when you work together, we can see the data move and we can see people's lives get improved.
Sandy, is this the direction in which we have to go locally and nationally, and that is, as government funding becomes more and more scarce, that we're going to have to rely more on the corporate world and other institutions to get us through these times?
Yes, indeed. It is the only way to go. Really, it fine-tunes our approach when we have to go to the private sector, because the private sector expects an outcome, a result, a metric, a pathway as a result of their investment. They expect return on their investment. The public sector does also, but in a different way. And as you build these public-private partnerships, you get a closer understanding and a closer interaction between the return on investment and the approach. One additional thing I'd like to say, so yes, Don, we've got to move this way, and it's going to make us better at what we do. But in addition to that, this very fine report can be used to help us to figure out how to reinvest public dollars. Look at every one of the categories that's listed in the 6 recommendations and ask ourselves, how much do we spend on mental health? currently? How much do we spend on early childhood education currently? And then ask the corresponding question, are we getting the right return or any return on that investment? And that can probably drive us to invest a different way. I bet we could find ways to give a lot more money to Chris and Beyond Housing for their initiatives at Normandy. And Urban is certainly standing in line for North St. Louis.
I want to piggyback on that comment, particularly with respect to mental health. So one of the things that we noted was that African Americans make up roughly 30% of the city and county combined, account for 42% of the hospital charges for mental health. And that's using the ER for mental health and being hospitalized for mental health. There's no reason that should be happening. People should be able to access high-quality, community-based outpatient mental health care. And that's where you can begin to see some of those dollars saved on the most expensive kind of intervention for any kind of health condition is the emergency room. If you can prevent those emergency room visits, that may be a way where you free up some of the money to do these other things.
But it also involves, Chris, I'll throw this one at you, it also involves political will. And we've seen in our state, for instance, some of the areas in which you would like to see a little more action, it's not happening because politics is reared its head.
Well, again, and so the way you move politics and public policy is public sentiment, right? So again, how do we use this report as a springboard, right? I think if you allow people to understand this simply, quickly, concisely, and they say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, what should we do, right? Here are some recommendations, and how do we garner, again, the public will, public sentiment, public support. To say we can change policies, we can reallocate resources, we can find new resources. It's not a simple task. It's not, oh, we'll do that in 6 months and I'll be taken care of, right? But again, if we're serious, finally, about improving the well-being for all of us, as Jason always reminds me, right, it's for the sake of all, right? It's not simply, oh, we're going to, make things better for those who are struggling. It's for everybody. And again, if we as a region embrace that and come together on, quite frankly, just some common sense stuff here, right? This is no radical, off-the-charts new stuff. This is all basic sense that's already backed up by research, and if we just have the courage to do it, we can make great things happen.
If we do it. Sandy, let me put this to you. We've got a couple of 100,000 kids in the state of Missouri who could benefit if our legislature would accept federal funding for Medicaid, for instance. That's not happening. It hasn't happened. It didn't happen last year. It didn't happen this year, and smart money would probably say it's not going to happen next year.
That's probably true. But I think the question you're asking me is what might we do or how do we get at that? And I this is another reason why this kind of report is so important, because I'm certain that we've got very smart legislators that if they can understand the cost to the system and the potential return on investment of behaving differently with the system, we may be able to move the needle. Sometimes we get stuck in public policy in the visceral and emotional responses that we have to things or practices. And this report is compelling us. And I think what we've got to do is to really start breaking this apart as a business proposition. Yeah. Does it really make sense?
So part of the challenge, I would allege, is John Doe Public has a busy life, have lots of things going on, and expansion of Medicaid does not impact them directly, right? And it's our challenge to convey to them the failure to expand Medicaid does impact you, and here is how, and at a minimum, you should care enough to say, it just makes sense that we should do that, and I want to lend my voice trying to make that happen.
Jason, I assume the copies of this report have been sent to Jefferson City by the caseload?
Absolutely. And we had several elected officials there with us on Friday. And I should say that we've talked to the mayor, we've talked to the president of the Board of Aldermen, the city treasurer, members of the Black Legislative Caucus at the state level, members of the governor's staff. So policy engagement with policymakers is definitely part of moving this forward.
All right. Go ahead,
John,
Sandy.
If I make one very quick observation here, and it is just an observation. Part, if I understand it, of the pushback on the expansion of Medicaid in Missouri is that we don't really want to take on additional debt that we can't sustain over time. In the early parts of the expansion, it would be paid for by the federal government, and our legislators careful as it should be for Missouri, say, well, but what happens when that goes away? I would say, let's post a different question. How much can we save now by expanding Medicaid and protecting the health of people? And can we then use those savings to close the gap in the event that the federal funding goes away in the future? This is the kind of analytic approach that I'm saying that takes us out of the visceral and makes us look at these things as a business proposition, and maybe we can move forward.
You would think, after all of the talk that's gone on this particular subject, that someone would have taken a look at some of these numbers. I want to go to the phones before we take our next break, because I want the callers to recognize we're going to get to them eventually. So we'll start with Dr. De Silva calling from Washington University. Go ahead, doctor. Thanks for waiting so long.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Yes, it's a very important subject. Let me first say my qualifications. I teach at WashU, UMSL, and original research in nutrition and prevention. So this is my area, and I have a company actually working to help St. Louisans and Missouri on this area, and actually are working with the Lutheran Foundation at the moment for seniors' lifestyle changes, particularly nutrition, dietary programs. This is not actually being in this report, as you gave the 6 points. I think we can come in together. I think number 3, which is the school health programs, and number 6 was infectious diseases. Now, actually, to tell you the truth, we have sequenced all our genes. We know that 99.9% we are all same. I'm Asian, you are white or African, whatever. And WashU is a leading institution where these genes have been sequenced, and we know exactly. But that's not the point. Point is the epigenetics, the environmental factors which impinge basically in this report. I mean, I don't know. You know, the reference points. We need to go back. I mean, science is so important for these children, and also the brain development of these children. I mean, I'm very interested in the young school-age going kids because our neuroscience, we know exactly how the brain develops now.
Okay,
there shouldn't be any problem in understanding this.
Dr. De Silva, let me stop you, and I hesitate to do so, but we have a time factor here, and I want to get a chance to have Jason respond to this. You've been acknowledging some of the things he said with regard to nutrition and brain development. And that
absolutely,
sort of
absolutely. And there's research coming out every day showing that poverty in particular has a significant and adverse outcome on the brain development of children. And poverty within childhood follows people into adulthood in terms of their health outcomes. Absolutely.
I have to take that break. Let's do that now. We are talking about the For Sake of All study, just recently recently released, that is. The man who is the driving force behind that is Jason Purnell. You just heard from him, of the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University. With me in studio is Chris Kraemeyer, President and CEO of Beyond Housing. And joining us by phone from Memphis is Sandy Moore, President of Urban Strategies. We'll come back, continue our conversation, and take more of your calls when we do. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. We are looking at the final report in the For Sake of All study examining the connection between health and opportunity among the region's African-American communities. My guests in studio, Professor Jason Purnell, Sandra Moore is with us by phone from Memphis, and Chris Kraemeyer also with us in studio. I'll go right to the phones because some people have been most patient. Let's get to them. Jim and Creve Coeur, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, Don. First of all, thank you for this vitally important study. May it by no means be shelved, but do a lot of good. Secondly, in view of factors which I think for a long time have been no secret, I'm personally surprised that a very significant discrepancy is startling. And then thirdly, in so much discussion, I mean, I'm thinking of the articles and essays on the anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision and so on, there seems to be an overlooking of family or social structure in poverty-stricken areas. I'm thinking, for example, of a study. Now, this was in a news magazine back in the 80s that I read that a number of young males were asked in their language, have you had offspring? And they said yes. And then they were asked, are you a father? And they said no. And the more recently, the in St. Louis, there was a clergy group written up in the Post-Dispatch that is trying to confront very nobly and I think hopefully ably the violence, the number of murders and so forth, especially in North St. Louis. And one of the clergy was quoted as saying, if these kids are hungry, and if you're hungry, you're going to act it out. And I agree, and yet millions of teens across the world are starving, not just hungry, but they're not killing their neighbors. And I'm wondering if, rather than a vicious circle, you know, poverty and then, you know, homelessness and lack of medical care, the closing of the medical facilities in North St. Louis and other areas of, where they're greatly needed, that's occurred in just the past few years, is alarming. And I'm wondering if a piece of, I have
get,
a couple
please,
who,
please, Jim,
well,
get,
I better,
get,
I'll
get
stop
to the
there,
question,
but I think
Jim.
You get the point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
okay.
You.
All right. I think Jim is essentially making the points that you've discovered in your findings.
He is, and you know, this worry about the black family is as old as the Moynihan Report, which we're all familiar with, and we've sort of tread that ground. What some of the more recent research shows, though, is that these economic issues are largely driving some of the family formation issues. It's not that people don't value marriage or don't value fatherhood or being involved in their families. It's that I don't have the economic wherewithal to provide for my family and therefore find it difficult to engage in some of what we take for granted as upper middle class people.
I mean, so for me, so, you know, the six recommendations are kind of the underpinnings for, again, how do we start creating opportunities for folks to have the lives that they want? And yeah. And I think some of the things, the litany of things that Jim alluded to, I think will start subsiding if these six things that can actually indeed be carried out and be brought to some level of scale, then a lot of other things change, right? As Jason said, look, if you're having all these other challenges in your life, you're not thinking of these other higher level needs that, again, sure, those of us in larger society will want you to tackle, right? So let's begin with giving you the right foundational base of how you can have the life you want.
It's basics. It's back to basics. Now, by the way, I'll remind our audience, Sandy, one second, please. I'll remind our audience that tomorrow we're doing a program on fatherhood, absent fathers, and the problems that this does create, and they are significant. And that involves all communities where this is an issue. But I think folks will be very, very surprised by how important an issue this is. Sandy, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, as I just want to say this very quickly. As a comprehensive community development professional, what I've learned is trying to decide whether it's the chicken or the egg is a paralyzing exercise. And Jim's comments can almost paralyze you. What we are trying to say here and what this study illuminates is that you really have to take an integrated approach across an outcome that you seek. And if, in fact, it is an outcome that we seek as a community, that people be healthy and vibrant and whole, then we have to work at that and do it in an integrated fashion. And that's what this this fine report helps us to do, to look at it that way. Otherwise, it becomes paralyzing. Do we start with the egg or do we start with the chicken?
And I would just note very quickly that young men across the world are engaged in violence. They're the ones who are driving most of the violence. Many of them are hungry. Many of them feel voiceless and powerless. We can look across the globe at that happening.
It's too easy to deal with stereotypes and just draw certain conclusions on the basis of, you know, what you see on Channel 5's first 5 minutes of their evening news every night. That's my soapbox for the moment. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Travis calling from Hannibal. Go ahead, Travis. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I was wanting to call about the issue because I am a white male, obviously, who was raised in a single-parent home. Never met my father, never seen my father until I was 18, first time I ever laid eyes on the man. So I feel like that I can relate to some of the issues when it comes to poverty. My mom was very poor, very unwise with her behavior and with, you know, money, things of that nature. So I feel like I can speak somewhat from a degree of understanding where some of these inner community, inner city people come from, and you men and women, young boys and girls. I just think the study is good and is intriguing, and it is important that it is, like the first point was, that it starts at a very young age. I think that's very important. But I think that all of this is futile if we do not, for one, as a society, value morality and responsibility. Because we can teach our children something, but somebody else can come along and teach them something differently. It is what we show them with our behavior as mentors, as somebody who's come out of a situation of this nature, that I find is really going to be the most effective. I'm not wanting to disannul some of the findings of at all in the report, but if we do not have a moral value in our society, then all of the studies and all of the number crunching will be futile. It will not work.
Travis, we have your point. Thank you. In the interest of time, I'm going to cut you off there. Jason, what do you think? Is there a morality quotient in your report?
Well, there's absolutely morality. I mean, the morality, the moral bottom line is that we ought to be caring that our neighbors, our friends, our children, our coworkers are dying and they don't have to. That's the moral case in a nutshell. But again, necessary but not sufficient. We know that the way the world works, we've also got to put a dollar sign next to some of these problems. So we've tried to make both the moral and the economic argument here.
Yeah, you cannot read this report and not be stirred from a moral and from an ethical standpoint about, look, this what's happening is just not right. And again, how do we collectively put our shoulder to the wheel to make things better?
Sandy, did that surprise you that someone thinks there is not a moral component to this?
If that is what the caller was suggesting, that he thinks there isn't a moral component, that is surprising because of what my colleagues have said. This is all about the morality of equity and an opportunity to live and live well. But I'm not sure that I picked that up from the caller. I think he was trying to give us an add-on, and that is that we really have to somehow think about how we strengthen the moral fiber inside of distressed communities that are being frayed with all of these things. And I think that is an important and valid point that we all work on. Maybe sometimes we work on it so diligently till it escapes us that we're working on it. But certainly we do.
Well, I certainly hope you're right on that. Okay, we'll take another call. Dennis in Overland, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yes, Don. As to the earlier caller talking about people around the world not killing themselves for food, I don't know what world he's looking at. There's loads of people killing themselves for lack of water and food, and I'm not trying to be smart. I'm just that is the reality when there's a lack there. I grew up in Normandy and later on moved down the road, and one of the guys that ran the district over here pointed out one of the problems that Normandy had long before white flight was cemeteries and golf courses. It's not easy. Those people don't pay much taxes. And the second part is, I think the way we do things in funding on our schools, we should take that gambling money and it should go to the school districts that are in need. That should be the first thing we do. Everybody else fund their own districts, put the money where it's needed to solve the problem, and then do whatever you have to do. And that would be better for all the other districts because they would not be feeling like they're being impacted necessarily. Then you could actually put the salve on the wound. And the other thing that's hanging right now is if I was a teacher in Normandy, I probably wouldn't go back without tenure.
All right.
I would never teach without tenure.
Dennis, thank you so much for the call. Time's getting away from us. You're the Normandy man, Chris Kramer.
Well, I mean, he's true in terms of the number of cemeteries and golf courses that do make it a little challenging. Mm-hmm. But again, and his idea of targeting dollars to the highest need makes a ton of sense, right? So again, is it the gambling money? You know, again, I think we can have that conversation. But I think the notion of where do we use resources? How do we use resources? How are we strategic in, again, delivering resources to the greatest need and have a delivery system that we're confident is going to have the kind of results that we're looking for? And clearly, places like Normandy, additional resources to tackle the things that are outside of the four walls of school are clearly going to be important for the longitudinal success of whoever runs the district.
I have an email here from Celine. I'll read. It says, I've been a pediatric nurse at one St. Louis Children's Hospital for over 30 years. I've often wondered, with all our resources, why can't St. Louis get something going along the line of the Harlem Children's Zone or the Harlem Renaissance Project that Jeffrey Kennedy has done very successfully in New York City? We've discussed that often and much on this program. Any thoughts, Chris? Do you have?
Well, yeah. I think that conceptual model, which is kind of the collective impact model that Jason alluded to earlier, urban strategies, Beyond Housing, many others. Jason alluded to the Ready by 21 initiative that's happening in other parts of the country. We are, you know, on the beginning cusp of that in a lot of places here in the region. And again, the challenge is bringing people together, finding the right resources, putting a plan together, and then executing. So she's absolutely right. We need more things like that. And I would allege there are things that are clearly brewing in this region that are akin, and I would allege some of us that think might be even a little bit better than the Harlem Children's Zone.
And I would add to that, some people downplay the importance of data and research and reports like this, but that is actually the area where we have probably the biggest weakness when we look at initiatives like collective impact, like the kind of Harlem Children's Zone. We need better data infrastructure to be able to measure whether or not what we're doing, even when we get to this collective impact model, is having some impact. And that's where academic partnerships with the community like this can have some leverage.
And, you know, it seems to me, if my understanding of what Jeffrey Kennedy is doing and as much positive publicity it has gotten, it's largely the result of some financial backing that is absent in most places, including our area right here. He's got some billionaires who are pumping a lot of money into this project, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that the Aspen Institute, which did a study of community change initiatives, looked at was that you're going to have to invest significant amounts of money in order to get the kinds of results that Jeffrey Kennedy gets. And very often we want to do these kinds of community change initiatives on a shoestring budget and expect miraculous outcomes. That's not going to happen.
That's where we need the Boeings of the world and others. Go ahead, Sandy. I know you wanted to say something.
And what I want to say about that is, and I've had the wonderful pleasure of working with Jeffrey in Camden, New Jersey, for just a minute. So what I will say about that is this. Jeffrey Kennedy would say to you, and with all that we've done and are doing in the Harlem Children's Zone, we're not rebuilding the physicality of Harlem in these neighborhoods, not wholesale. So again, as wonderful as his outcomes are, it's with millions of dollars, and there's still a plank or a piece yet that needs to be added. That is the comprehensiveness and the integratedness and the focus on place in addition to people that we have to really get ourselves attuned to.
We have just 2 minutes left, and I know the report ends, Jason, with a call to action. We've probably alluded to several elements of that during the course of the program, but I'll ask you to synopsize again what has to be done.
I think what has to be done and what we're focusing on going forward is continuing to explain and translate this for the community. We're interested in putting together some discussion guides and some action toolkits for community members, continuing to engage policymakers at the state and local level, and to the extent that it's relevant, the federal level, and continuing to engage the business community so that we make the business case, the economic case for why we need to intervene for the sake of all. Across these sectors, we're going to have to work across our silos. We're going to have to incentivize this kind of collective impact approach. And it's going to take all hands on deck. This isn't just about health. Everybody's going to have to be involved.
Chris, let me give you 30 seconds, then we'll go to Sandy for a final thought.
Again, I think the call to action is these are all solvable issues, right? These are things, this is not, you know, curing cancer, to use another medical analogy, right? This is about investing in our region, in our community, in our neighbors, and the people that have the same aspirations and dreams that we do. And we just have not said we're going to invest the dollars that will improve their lives. And as a byproduct, guess what? The region gets stronger and we all benefit. So, again, my hope is that this is a call to action and we're all willing to roll up our sleeves and say we can get after this. We just have the courage and the will to do so.
And Sandy, we'll give you the final word.
I'd say that we really got to get very serious about rewarding the behavior that we seek. As a community, that's what we've got to really focus on. If we want to shift the outcomes that this report highlights for us, then we've got to start to seriously think about how do we incentivize, as my colleagues have said, but more importantly, how we move away from punitive and toward rewarding the behavior that we seek from individuals, from neighborhoods, from communities, from partners.
And it's in all of our hands, is it not? Thank you so much, all of you, for being with us and bringing us more information on this report. Jason Purnell, it's been a pleasure working with you over the last year and bringing this information to the public. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Sandy Moore, thank you so much for being with us. Enjoy your time in Memphis, and we'll see you back in St. Louis one of these days soon, I hope. And Chris Kramer, always good to see you. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here, Don.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we will talk about the importance of fathers in the lives of their children. Then we'll talk with a filmmaker about his documentary, Examining White Flight. He looks at it from the perspective of his hometown of Spanish Lake. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stopublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.